Hello, I'm Dr. Pamela Brewer, and you are listening to Men's Monday here on Mind Talk, the show that provides you with relationship health and mental health information every day. On Men's Monday, we focus on all things for and about men.
Today's guest is someone who is sharing with us a very difficult experience that he's had, but somehow found a way to come through on the other side. I am pleased to introduce to you Tim Hollister, who is the dad of Reed Hollister and the author of His Father Still, a parenting memoir. Tim, welcome to Mind Talk.
I'm honored to be your guest. Thank you.
Now, Tim, let's start with the title, His Father Still, a Parenting Memoir. What do you mean by that?
It's very simple. The book is about my parenting of my teenage son, Reed, when he was 13 through 17, then his death in an auto crash in 2006, and then my obligations as a father in the aftermath of his crash, and then my rebuilding of my father-son relationship with him over time. So the point is that you're never not a parent, even when tragedy strikes.
And I think that is, as I was going through your book, really thinking that this was a very interesting and expansive approach to a story really about profound grief. Let's talk about your son. Introduce him to us.
Reed was, first of all, adopted. We adopted him when he was 11 weeks old, which I always point out because he was a very handsome young man, and I always am quick to say he did not get his good looks from me. but he... He was an energetic, rambunctious, sometimes rebellious, especially when he was a teen. He had a lot of friends. He was not in any way gifted. He wasn't a great scholar. He wasn't a great athlete. I think one of the appeals maybe of my new book, His Father Still, is that he was an ordinary kid. He was the boy next door, sort of a typical teenager, and If he excelled in anything, he was the one kid in the group who was the first to diagnose that one of his friends was sad or concerned about something, and the first one to say, you know, how are you doing? How can I help you? And so he had a lot of friends, and he had a lot of girlfriends, but he was the one who stood out for his empathy. I'll say that, and you know, he had some talents. He had a nice singing voice, and he had a great sense of humor. His antics delighted us all the time. But I think the main point is, you know, he was an ordinary kid. He was not an exceptional scholar, athlete, you know, musician, artist, whatever. He was he excelled in being a good friend to his friends.
And he was very much an important part, clearly, of your family, and brought a lot of energy, it sounds like, to your family dynamic.
Absolutely. A lot of people would say that when Reed was around, you never knew what was going to happen next, and I mean that in a good way, mostly. He would come up with funny stuff. I can just give you one little vignette from the book. We were out on a car ride out in the western part of the United States, and I think it was in central Utah, you know, one of those interminable stretches of road where you try to play a little family game to get the time to pass. And we said to Reed, all right, what would your ideal evening be? And his answer was sitting in the cockpit of an F-16 eating spaghetti. and that was just so typical, Reed. It was so funny. It was so out of left field, but it was just so him, because he would say stuff like that that would keep us laughing all the time.
It sounds like you almost couldn't help but smile when he was around.
Oh, absolutely. Except when he and I were butting heads, which was most of the time.
Well, and is also very typical as children grow
exactly.
Older. You start off your story asking, I think, the age-old parenting question of how much space do I give this child? How much do I hold on? How tightly do I hold? How much room do I give? Talk about that question, which is a question that every parent, I think, struggles with.
Indeed. His Father Still is based on two realities of parenting. The first is that parents need to balance teaching their kids about risk with protecting them from danger. And the second is, as kids grow into teens, we give them more and more freedom, but as a result, we know less and less about them. So Reed, as a teenager, challenged me every day with rebellion. He had attention deficit disorder. He had some misconduct in school. And then after he died, I was consumed as a father by two questions. Had I balanced giving him freedom with protecting him? And who was he as a person at the time he passed away? And so his father still is a candid account of parenting a challenging teenager, but it's also the story of how, mainly from hundreds of condolence messages, I learned much more about my son's character after he died than I knew when he was alive, and how I used those insights to rebuild a sustainable relationship with him. So the core theme is, as you just said, this balance that parents have to approach every day about giving their kids freedom, but also protecting them when they get too close to danger.
You said that your son was diagnosed with ADHD. How did that impact him at home and at school?
Well, he struggled as a student. He, as many ADHD or ADD kids do. You know, we had him. This was in the early 2000s. We had him on a regimen of Ritalin, and I think there was one other mind drug, which helped a little bit. Certainly, when he started driving, we absolutely made sure that he had taken his Ritalin before he got behind the wheel. And as an aside, I don't think anybody believes there was any connection between his crash and his Ritalin or his ADHD. But you know, ADHD is something it requires a very tailored, hands-on approach to education. We put him in a private school because we were lucky enough to have that option, but also we thought he would get more attention to his attention deficit disability, I guess you would call it. And one of the things that I talk about in his father still is it turned out to not be a very good match between what he needed and what the school was able to provide. So ADHD is certainly a challenge with education for teens, and then it also can be a behavioral challenge, of course.
But I think it was an important aside that you offered that his crash had nothing to do with that diagnosis or with his medication.
Right.
I also observed that as you were talking about the funeral preparations, you made it clear that you didn't want any of the administrators from the school that you just talked about to participate in any of the services related to your son. So talk about the school. You know, at first blush, you hear private school, you think it certainly has the potential for being a wonderful, hands-on, affirming experience. But that's not quite what happened with your son. What did happen?
Well, the private school that we chose is sort of a typical suburban, medium-sized private school. I mean, not a particularly educationally themed in any way, but you know, a good reputation for academics and sports. But between his ADHD and then some issues of misconduct, I think it's fair to say that the school lost faith in him and thought toward the end of his life. I mean, obviously, no one knew the crash was coming, but in the last few months of his life, that maybe they regretted admitting him in the first place, and he just sort of floundered both in terms of his own misconduct and the school not really responding to his needs during those last few months, which was the middle of his senior year in high school. So then right in November, this time, in fact, it was this week, 9 years ago, that he was accused of serious misconduct at the school. And then as the situation was unfolding was when he died. So there was a lot of anger. There was a lot of inability of him or our family to sort of get the truth out there as to what the nature of the misconduct was. There were rumors that it was an ugly situation. And one of the things I talk about in his father still is that if I had only had my grief to deal with, it would have been one thing. But we had anger plus this just mind-bogglingly complicated and fast-moving and unfair situation with his school to deal with, and you know, I didn't write his father still to set the record straight, but I think it may actually have a little bit of that effect.
Well, I suspect that you're right, as I was looking at what he was accused of and then how ultimately responses impacted how people began to think about him in a more accurate way after he died. And, you know, just to hear you talk about the difficulties that he was having in his senior year is, I don't know, it just kind of feels like a tragedy all by itself. I mean, he had gotten to his senior year, and the school, for some of the reasons that you described, it sounds like they just withdrew their support.
We'll never know for sure. There was certainly a lot of twisting of facts. One of the people have told me that one of the most interesting and moving parts of his father still is the statement that Reed wrote to the disciplinary committee of the school explaining his version of the events. And people ask me, well, you know, after he passed away, did you believe what he said? And I said, yes. And not just because he was my son, but because you can tell sometimes when something has the ring of truth. And the accusation, I mean, the basic point is the accusation of misconduct was taken out of context. I'm not saying he didn't do something wrong. He did. But the situation morphed out of control, and that was right when he died. So it was just a, you know, and I go through that situation in the book really to not to retry the facts, but to get parents to focus on what's important in those very difficult situations. And what's important is to keep your son or daughter, you know, tell them to keep their head up and keep plugging and not to give up just because one situation got out of control.
And, you know, again, here was a kid. He was an ordinary, everyday kid. Parents deal with children who get into trouble at school all the time.
Right.
And, you know, depending on the parent, that certainly has a huge impact on how they deal with and support or withdraw support from the child, depending on what the trouble is. You talked about, there were some interesting circumstances that arose in your life just before Tim died. You talked about having to go to a meeting and the weather was bad. Take us through that day when the meeting that you were to attend in Chicago, I think, was changed to Washington, D.C.
December 1st, 2006 was right on the cusp of the events that we've been talking about at his school. And I was supposed to go to Chicago for a business meeting on Saturday morning, and then fly back that night. And then then it started snowing in Chicago, and the meeting was moved by our chairman by email to Washington D.C. So I left Connecticut that afternoon. My plane was delayed several times, and I got to Washington D.C. And that was where I got first an email and then a phone call from my wife saying that Reed had been in a crash. And the upshot of it was that I ended up getting in a car and driving from Washington, D.C., leaving there just before midnight on Friday night, and driving 5.5 hours back to Hartford. There's enough time and distance between those events, and now that I can joke, I tell my friends, try driving from Washington, D.C. to Hartford in 5.5 hours. There are days when you can't do it in 12 hours. But I was driving in the middle of the night, and I got to the hospital 2 hours after he died. And I've often speculated about what would have happened if I had been snowbound in Chicago and learned that my son had passed away. But so it was the snowstorm in Chicago just completely rearranged the day in a way that turned out to be just an unbelievable stroke of, I'll put luck in quotes, because obviously it was a tragic day, but it was quite a confluence of events.
I know that you have become a nationally known advocate for safer teen driving, but I'd like to stay with that day, that evening that you were driving from Washington, D.C. back to Hartford for a moment. Barreling down the highway, clearly, getting there in 5.5 hours, what was going through your mind? How were you keeping yourself literally on the road, given the emotional stress and angst that was in front of you?
Well, when I left Washington, all I knew was that Reed had been in a crash and that he was being admitted to Hartford Hospital. I had my cell phone on. Of course, the battery was dying. Murphy's Law of cell phone batteries kicking in. But so I told my in-laws that I would call at the top of each hour, which I did at midnight, and I did at 1 o'clock, and I did at 2 a.m. At 2 a.m., I asked to speak to my wife, and they said she was not doing well and couldn't come to the phone. At that point, I was in New Jersey, and I knew that things were not going well. So at that point, I just shut the phone off. And I guess the best word to describe my mental state in that last part of the drive in the middle of the night was compartmentalization, which is that you just try to put it in a box, nail the lid shut, and not pay attention to it because you have to drive. And as I said, I was blessed that I was basically the only car on the road, which is almost unheard of on Interstate 95, but it was 3-4 o'clock in the morning that I was driving back. And, then I got to the hospital, and the senior minister of our church met me at the front door and explained what had happened, and at that point, just collapsed.
You collapsed?
Yes.
What a moment. What a message, what a piece of information to be given, one that in so many ways is every parent's fear, worst nightmare, and you never expected to happen, and there you were in the middle of it.
Right. Right. I was glad that it was the minister of my church. One thing I often say looking back on the experience is that how did my family get through the tragedy? The three F's, faith, family, and friends, we're lucky to have all three in great numbers and abundance. But it was, again, as you've seen from looking at the book, there's a chapter called Small Mercies. That's the next to last chapter of the book where I talk about, I forced myself to write down a long list of all the good things that happened. And one of them was that I was met at the door by an enormously caring man who was a big part of my faith. And I'm not an overly religious person. I am a Christian. I've been a member of a church for a long time, but very much felt that I just sort of committed myself to the care of Jesus at that moment. And the fact that my minister was there literally and figuratively to receive me was a great comfort. Hmm.
We will return in just a moment with Tim Hollister, who is the author of His Father Still, a parenting memoir, The Father of Reed Hollister. We'll be right back. Tim, there are many times when tragedies can bring a family closer together, and there are certainly times when tragedies can actually pull a family apart. Talk for a moment, if you would, about your family, your wife and your daughter's reaction, and what the three of you did coming together during this tragedy.
First of all, with regard to my wife, one of the realities is that neither of us, looking back from Reed's crash and before, blames. We don't blame each other for his crash or the events leading up to it. It was we both agree that if we had switched places, we wouldn't have done anything differently. And that's really important, because sometimes a tragedy is can get pinned on one parent versus the other, and obviously that can precipitate enormous anger and distrust, and sometimes that can destroy a marriage. Number two is that in the aftermath of Reed's crash, when we were doing the just unbelievable tasks of, you know, planning his memorial service and choosing his casket and figuring out what he was going to wear when he would be buried, all that stuff, my wife and I would look back on those times now and say, we made the decisions together. We made them unanimously. There was no rancor. There was no disagreement. And again, that's not always going to be the case. And third is, we still have a daughter, 2 years younger than Reed. And, so we, and I'll come back to her in a minute, but, you know, we were united in our need to focus on her needs. The fact is, 9 years later, my wife and I are still together, and I think it's because of the circumstances that I just outlined. Now, my daughter, who is now a college student, has a different situation. She would be the first, and by the way, she's given me sort of tacit permission to speak somewhat obliquely about her situation, which is part of her courage and her gift to me. But you know, she struggled more than anybody, because she and her brother were very, very close, and they're both adopted from different biological parents. They're not related in that sense. But, you know, she struggled, as younger siblings often do. She felt as though her mission in the first year or so after Reed's crash was to take care of us, which we kept telling her was not her, you know, not her responsibility. And then she sort of segued into just being lost as to, you know, how can this happen, confronting mortality and so forth. And it's been a long, difficult process for her, and sometimes when I'm talking about the book or my family situation, people ask me about closure, and I just give that a quick laugh and say, no, there's no such thing as closure in this situation. There's compartmentalization, there's progress, there's dealing with it, there's moving on, but there's nothing that you would ever say is closure.
You know, as you're talking about your wife and your daughter, it seems to me that there must have been quite a strong and solid bond, family bond, before the crash, that was the underpinning that allowed the two of you to approach this horrific circumstance as a unit, as a family. How involved was your daughter? She was younger than Reed. She is younger than Reed. How involved was she in the actual planning of the funeral and picking out the casket and those kinds of things?
I think with every decision that we made in those couple of days and then weeks, my wife and I would discuss whether my daughter should be brought in. And there were some decisions where she clearly should have been involved and was, and there were some that maybe wasn't appropriate.
Okay.
The financial, for example, you know, there are financial implications. There was actually some litigation between the families of Reed. Reed had two passengers with him who were injured and recovered, but there, as is always the case, there was some litigation following the crash, and, you know, we tried to keep Martha out of that. But, you know, anything where we had to make a sort of a judgment call about how best to honor Reed and his memory, Martha was a participant. And one little vignette that I talk about in the book is that she, you know, we sort of thought that she was interested in art and drawing, and she totally surprised us by coming up with a pen and ink drawing of her brother 2 days after his crash, and that sort of became a focal point of the funeral service and the calling hours at the funeral home, where people realized that my daughter has some artistic talent. You know, what a way and what a time to find out. But it was just this beautifully rendered drawing of her brother's face, and that was when we learned she was a talented artist.
It's amazing the way parents learn about their children's gifts and sometimes never do learn. Do you feel comfortable letting us know the nature of the litigation?
Oh, I mean, it was personal injury litigation for medical expenses.
Okay.
It was handled by the insurance companies and settled. Nothing out of the ordinary in that, and not unexpected. But I mean, the families that sued us at one point we were very much closer to them than we were after the litigation.
Well, I can understand that. Let's talk about the actual crash. What did happen?
On a Friday night, so again, I was in Washington, D.C. on a business trip, and my wife was home in the neighborhood a couple doors away. And in the early evening, Reed was home in the basement with his sister Martha watching movies. And apparently the two girls from our neighborhood came and suggested to Reed that they go for a joyride. Reed sent me a text message while I was at dinner in Washington, which said he was going to Mike's house. Mike was his best friend, lived in the next town over. So basically he lied to me and told me he was going in one direction for one purpose, and they ended up with the two girls going in the other direction on an interstate highway. And so no parents knew that the three kids were out in the car. But they got on Interstate 84 West, which is the main drag through central Connecticut, and then they tried to turn around to get the girls back before their curfew, which was 10:30, and they got lost. They ended up going further west on the interstate. So now they finally got turned around, and now they're running late. Now they're going to blow the girls' curfew. So as best we can tell, Reed was driving on the interstate at night, you know, with teen driver, with teen passengers, and over the speed limit to get the girls home on time or as close to their curfew as possible. So he came up on a fairly sharp curve where there had been a lot of crashes over the years, went too far straight into the curve, realized he was out of position, jammed the wheel to the right the way an inexperienced driver would, did two 360-degree spins on the highway, and his car, which was a 99 model car, had a driver airbag but not side airbags, hit the butt of a guardrail right in the middle of the driver's side door, pushed the door in about 3 feet, crushed the left side of his chest, and he went into immediate cardiac arrest and pronounced dead a couple hours later at the hospital.
It's almost breathtaking to hear you. It is breathtaking to hear you describe those last few moments of his life. And I note that you have become, as I said a little bit earlier, truly a nationally known advocate for safer teen driving. Talk about that for a moment. I want to come back to your son and his story, but talk about your work as an advocate for safer teen driving.
Sure. A year after Reed's crash, Connecticut had back-to-back multiple fatality teen driver crashes, 7 deaths in 6 weeks. And that was in the fall of 2007. And at that point, our governor said enough is enough and appointed a task force to overhaul our teen driver laws, which at the time were among the most lenient in the nation. And she appointed me as a parent who had lost a teen driver. Long story short, serving on that task force, when we did overhaul our teen driver law, making it now one of the strictest in the nation, but I learned that during the 11 months that I supervised Reed's driving, 11 months, by the way, where he drove crash-free, but I learned that I really had not been a well-informed parent, that there were all these dangers in teen driving that I really didn't know about, and that I had done a lot of very bad, stupid parent oversight things. I let him get exposed to some real dangers that I never should have. So anyway, so out of the experience of serving on that task force, in 2009, I started my blog for parents of teen drivers, a national blog called From Reed's Dad. And after 3 years of posting, some of the national traffic safety organizations came to me and said, you know, would it make sense to take your blog posts and turn them into a book? And so I did that. And so my first book, which is called Not So Fast, Parenting Your Teen Through the Dangers of Driving, was published in 2013 by the Chicago Review Press. And we've gotten some very nice national recognition, and I, you know, the recognition is nice. It's the proof that we've saved lives that keeps me going with those activities.
What were some of the things that you learned about teen driving that surprised you?
Well, I have put, whenever I talk to parents now about safe teen driving, I talk about the five biggest dangers in teen driving that parents can control, and the fact that I these are areas that I, you know, sort of knew a little bit about, but not anywhere near how dangerous it was. So I've reduced it to an easy to remember formula called PACTS, P-A-C-T-S. Passengers, that's teen drivers with teen passengers, alcohol and drugs, which is impaired driving, curfews, the C stands for curfews, and night driving, T is texting, and S is seatbelts. So I tell parents, if you focus on those five areas with your teen, not that you'll have a safe driver, because teen drivers have four times the crash rates of the best drivers, then that's always has been and probably always will be the case. But at least if you focus on PACTS, you'll be exerting your energy in the right place and hopefully lowering the odds of your teen getting in a serious crash.
The book, Not So Fast, Parenting Your Teen Through the Dangers of Driving, is that something that is readily available for parents to pick? Okay,
yeah.
Terrific.
Yeah, no, it's on all the national, on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, IndieBound. It's both books are on all the national retailers.
Great. Let's go back to the experience post the funeral. Well, let me ask you a couple of questions about the funeral itself. As I said earlier, you and your wife made the decision not to invite any of the administrators who'd participated in his not being in the school. They were not welcome to any of the events.
That's correct, and that was just we wanted to deal with our grief and not our anger.
You also alerted the adoption agency for them to alert the birth parents. Talk about that decision.
Well, of course, in the 3 or 4 days after his crash, there were a lot of things going on. But along the way, it occurred to us that Reed's birth parents certainly should know. But we didn't take it upon ourselves to contact them directly and indeed, you know, because of confidentiality, we didn't know exactly where they are. I sort of had an idea that they were both in New England, but we turned it over to the adoption agency. And apparently what happened was that the adoption agency found the birth mother, but it was a day after the memorial service. So she showed up at the church the day after the service and asked for a copy of the program. And one of the ministers had a very nice conversation with her. And indeed, one of the things I talk about in His Father Still, that led a couple weeks later to me, you know, 17 years after we had adopted their son, meeting the birth mother again, which we had done during the adoption process, but it was a little bit strange, eerie to meet 17 years later under those circumstances. But she was just incredibly gracious and supportive, and not blaming anybody, not vindictive, and we ended up having a distant but warm, supportive relationship with her over the years since then.
That's interesting. Would you recommend that kind of thing to parents of adopted children when there's something significant that happens in their child's life, or was it specifically around this particular tragedy that caused you to reach out to her via the adoption agency in the way that you did?
That's a hard question because every situation is going to be different. I mean, there's a whole spectrum of how adoptions are handled now, which differs even from 25 years ago when we adopted Reed. There are very open relationships and very confidential relationships and everything in between. I think in this particular instance, we just felt as though that it had been such a, you know, cataclysmic event that we had an obligation to let the parents know. And very candidly, you know, we had so many other things on our mind, we sort of turned it over to the adoption agency thinking they, A, could handle it, and B, would handle it in the most the gentlest and most supportive way, which they did.
Excellent. You talk about your role as caretaker of your son's name, which is an interesting way to think about your life after his death. What was going on for you when you say you were the caretaker of his name? What were you wanting to accomplish?
Well, the first thing is, because of the tumultuous events of the last few weeks of his life, the disciplinary situation at his school, and this is described in a fair amount of detail in his father's still, I had a need to set the record straight about what happened and what didn't happen after his crash, because there was a lot of speculation about whether his crash was tied to the accusation of misconduct at his school. So there was very much I had to protect him from rumors that were flying around our community. But beyond that, I think this is more true of every parent who's been through a similar tragedy, is you need to preserve your child's memory in the minds not just of your family but of your community in an appropriate way. And it's not an easy decision as to how to do that. You have things like social media to deal with. I talk about that in the book. And so there's what is going to be said, to whom is it going to be said, how is it going to be said, and what will be the, if I can use the phrase, the takeaways that people will have about your child's life. And it's an enormously complicated, and in our case, a fast-moving situation. But I definitely felt this overwhelming responsibility to protect my son's reputation and to make sure that it was truthful. I think since you've looked at the book, you would agree I didn't spare any detail about his misconduct. I didn't whitewash his life, but I did want the truth out there.
Did the school ever offer an apology or a statement or any? Did the school reach out to you in writing in any way after Reed's death?
Well, that's a kind of a delicate question. I will simply say that over the 18 months after his crash, we resolved our differences with the school.
Okay.
So I'll leave it at that.
Spoken like a true attorney.
Yes, that's true.
All right. You do talk about our electronic funeral is the way you describe it in the book. And, you know, it is so extraordinary the way social media has absolutely changed every single person on the planet's life, and in ways that you don't really think about. You know, as I picked up your book and began to read it, social media was clearly nowhere in my head. And then as you raise the issue of an electronic funeral, I thought about it and I said, he's absolutely right. This is a whole new area in which people have to think about their lives and, sadly, in your case, a death. We're going to take a break, Tim, but when we come back, I'd like to talk more about that, about social media and how that impacted you and your family and the steps you and your family and your daughter took in the world of social media.
Yep.
Folks, this is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk. You're listening to my conversation with Tim Hollister, the author of His Father Still, a parenting memoir. We'll return in just a moment.
Thank you.
Tim, talk about your electronic funeral.
It's hard for us in 2015 to remember the time when there was no such thing as Facebook or the chronology, but the chronology is that 2005, Facebook was established on college campuses initially, and then in 2006 was really the year that it became what you might call a mainstream worldwide phenomenon. And the reality is that the first time I logged onto Facebook was 3 days after Reed's crash, because my niece, who was a recent college graduate and had told me what Facebook was, she said, "There's this group on Facebook." And I didn't really understand what that was. So I logged on for the first time and was confronted with a group of about 800 kids talking about my son. And so I didn't understand, again, what a group was. I didn't really understand what Facebook was. So initially I was confused. Then I was furious as I was reading, sort of casual offhand comments with no punctuation and no diction and no rules, just, sort of free-form communication that we're now so used to on social media. But meanwhile, as I'm reading through these posts that went on for, pages and pages and pages, I'm learning all these things about my son that I never knew. And so that's what the chapter, Our Electronic Funeral, is about. At the end of that chapter, I sort of philosophize a little bit about whether social media adapted to a tragedy is a good thing or a bad thing. Looking back, I think people would say that that the Virginia Tech massacres was the first time that people really focused on social media in the wake of a tragedy. I think they had a group of like 215,000 or something like that. But you would hope that condolence messages would be personal, private, and thoughtful. And we know, of course, that posts on social media are anything but. So I try to make the point at the end of that chapter that if you're going to use social media to convey condolence or feelings of sympathy, you have to think very carefully about doing that, because the form of the social media is not very well aligned with the purposes of condolence.
There was a point at which your daughter, Martha, sort of weighed in on some of the things that folks were saying. Was that helpful to you, and was that helpful to her to participate in that way?
Yes. I was shocked by this whole experience. So imagine, I'm sitting at my computer at probably midnight, scrolling through these posts on this Reed Hollister Facebook group, and there's a post from my daughter Martha, and that was that was yet another shock. That was where I learned that my daughter was on Facebook. After people started speculating about the physical causes of his crash and who was in the car and who was driving, she stepped in and said, no, that's not what happened. And so I was enormously proud of her, A, for stepping in to shut down the speculation, and B, for, understanding the medium and introducing a forceful message. And indeed, her intervention really redirected the conversation that was going on online, straightened it out. There was no more what I'll call ghoulish speculation after she stepped in. So it was quite an extraordinary moment, again, because I was confronting this new technology, and then I was also very proud of my daughter for what she did.
And what did you learn about your son through Facebook?
Well, how much time have you got? I learned a lot about him. I think it's fair to say that one of the themes of his father still is that when he was a teenager, he and I butted heads almost every day, and again, not atypical for a father and of a 16, 17 year old, but we were at loggerheads quite often. And so now I'm reading through these posts and learning that not just that people liked him as a friend, but he had so many friends to whom he meant so much. So there was a pen and ink painting, and now the colors are starting to be added by his friends to create the portrait. It was very much that type of experience. And I learned that, as I said at the beginning of our talk, that his strength as a person, which I really had not focused on because of so much of our daily existence was challenges and rebuttals and stuff like that. But, you know, his strength as a person was in being a good friend to others and empathizing. And that's probably the most important thing that I learned. And this was a, it may be hard to say or hard to comprehend, but this was a mother load of information because, again, it was almost 800 kids all talking about him in different ways. So it was just, at the time, it was unbelievable. I still sort of marvel at the whole experience.
It sounds like an astounding moment when you first actually looked at it and saw that it existed and the size of the group. And certainly we know that decorum and spelling and things like that often don't make their way into Facebook posts.
Right.
How are you and your family doing today as we speak?
As I said before, there's no such thing as closure. I think I can say each of us in a different way has reached what I'll call equilibrium. I have a busy work life here, my wife and I are still together. My wife has a busy life as she volunteers for a lot of different activities, and my daughter has now found a college and an academic path that she seems comfortable with. So, Reed is very much a presence in our daily lives. We haven't put him aside. He's not the unmentionable one. We talk about him all the time. And he's sometimes a sad presence. He's sometimes a funny presence, but he is always a presence. And I think we as a family feel as though we have created a, and I hate to use this word as a cliche, but a sustainable way of dealing with his crash in our daily lives.
You know, I think about those families when they do sustain a loss of a child, and for some, as you know, they really do put things in compartments. And there are some families in which once that loved one, that child is gone, there's also silence, and there's no real permission to talk about that loved one who's gone. And I think that for those family, that often, you know, at least potentially bodes the beginning of the end for a real family connection. And I'm struck by the fact that in your family, your son remains very much a part of your lives.
I can give you a concrete example, a conversation I had just this past weekend with a mother who lost her 8-year-old son to a lightning strike in 1975. And this boy's older sister told me that her mother had read His Father Still, and the family had a conversation about Joey for the first time in 40 years. Yeah, and I think the point being that I think part of the great response that I'm getting to His Father Still is that, number one, families tell me that they see themselves in my story, but also that they find it easier to talk about their own situations and their own tragedies. And again, I don't view His Father Still as a grief recovery book. I think it's a parenting book, a parent-child relationship book, and so I think the story that the daughter, the sister of the boy who died, told me about her and her parents illustrates that. It brings the parenting realities to the surface and hopefully makes it, even though it can be a painful book to read, makes it easier for people to talk about that in comparison to my story, if I can phrase it that way.
Absolutely. I mean, it facilitates conversations that clearly in one family's case didn't happen for 40 years and might not ever happen for some families, but for your providing a space for people to think about. And as you say, use your story as sort of the conduit by which they can think about their own stories in their own lives. I wanted to step back a moment. You said that in Connecticut, the teen driving laws at one point were among the most lenient in the country, and they have since changed a great deal. What were they, and how are they different now?
When I go around the country talking to parents and traffic safety organizations, that people find this hard to believe, but we have in Connecticut a required 2-hour safety class for parents before their teens can get a driver's license. So when the teen has a learner's permit, they have to show up at the driving school with one parent in tow, and they verify the attendance, and the parents sit and learn for 2 hours about safe teen driving. As you can imagine, as a public policy matter, there was a huge amount of pushback when this was first introduced, but most recently, the surveys that have been done of the parents that have taken the class, 90% of them say, okay, I guess that was worthwhile. I learned some stuff that I didn't know. We, in Connecticut, over 8 years since we overhauled our law, we have a 71% reduction in our fatality rates among 16 and 17-year-old drivers. In addition to the parent class, we have tighter limits on teen drivers with teen passengers. We have a stricter curfew. We closed a DUI loophole that actually figured in one of the those multiple fatality crashes that in 2007 that I mentioned before. We have mandatory license revocations when there's a violation of the teen driver laws, and no texting, no electronic devices, and mandatory seatbelts.
So it really sounds like you've covered all the bases. And honestly, you know, a 2-hour safety class for parents, I mean, I understand that folks tend to push back against anything when they're told they have to do it. I mean, that's just right. Kind of sort of how we are as human beings. But, right. You know, when you think about it, a 2-hour safety class for parents, I would think that parents would really embrace that opportunity, because as you've said, so many parents, you really don't know how much to give, how much to pull back. You just don't know. And yeah. Driving can, certainly it's a rite of passage for teenagers, but it's also, almost a rite of panic for parents.
Yeah. Well, the way I explain Connecticut's situation is, the deal here in Connecticut is that if you're going to put your 16 or 17-year-old out on the road as a driver, we need 2 hours of your time. And I don't think that's an unreasonable and indeed, the what's happening right now, I mean, in the last 60 days, is we've now standardized the curriculum for the 2-hour class in a way that will deliver more uniform and improve messages. We've sort of taken the best practices that have evolved at the driving schools and combined them and packaged them, and so I think we're going to get even better now that we have the structure in place.
And is that structure available online for folks to take a look at?
It is on the Connecticut Department of Motor Vehicles website. You can see the 2-hour class curriculum readily available and very readable. But it was done by Connecticut Children's Medical Center, which has been a great partner of mine in my safe teen driving activities.
Tell us what you want parents to really take away from your experience. I mean, we've talked about many things, the value of having conversations with your spouse, the value of honoring your child's life after death, the value of utilizing, if you have a faith base, utilizing that faith base. Is there anything else that you would really want parents to take from His Father Still?
The most important thing is that parents should approach parenting as what might be called risk assessment. This balance of protecting our kids from danger versus exposing them to danger, because we need to teach them about life's risks and where things can result in injury or death. So there's the approach of risk assessment, but then, you know, every child and every situation is different, but think of it as a continuum. The mantra is, well, we need to let our kids make mistakes. Well, hopefully no parent would use that approach in driving, because a mistake in driving can have catastrophic consequences. But, school is a different dynamic. If your student is failing, do you intervene or do you let them fail and hope that they get a lesson out of it? A different set of questions for the internet and social media. Do you let your child be bullied online just so they know how it feels, or do you step in and shut it down before it happens. So I my goal in writing His Father Still was to give parents a story. And again, I say I'm not an expert. I'm not a therapist. I'm not a psychologist. I'm a dad with a story and a keyboard. I want parents to see, take my story and use it as a reflection point for their own lives. And that this is not kids who have died or kids who have been in serious crashes. This is my intent was this is a book for parents with happy, healthy, well-adjusted kids, and it's to give them a comparison, a thought-provoking a situation that they can use to make sure that they strike this correct balance. So that's, I think that's what I'm about. And indeed, I guess my vindication, if I can call it that, over the last 8 weeks since the book was published is that I'm getting emails from parents around the country saying, I see my family in your story. Thank you. So that makes me feel good.
Well, I'm not sure that a vindication is needed, but I hear you. Your blog from Reed's Dad, what would one find taking a look at that blog?
The blog is historically been focused on safety and driving issues, so there's an archive that goes back to September 2009. I think there's maybe 200 posts, many of which, as I said, are now collected in my book, Not So Fast, but there's 5-6 years of posts about safety and driving. In the last 6 months, based on the publication of His Father Still, I have segued into more parenting issues, and there's I've republished with permission some of the emails that I've gotten from parents about the book. So that's the blog part, and then there's information about His Father Still, about Not So Fast, and Not So Fast was also published 60 days ago in Spanish as No Tan Rapido, and there's information about that.
That's wonderful. And that is from Reed, R-E-I-D-S, from reedsdad.org.
Correct.
Terrific. Tim Hollister, thank you so much for the work that you do and for spending time with us today.
My pleasure.
And folks, thank you for listening to this edition of Mind Talk. You can listen to this program again and all Mind Talk programs on demand at mindtalk.org. That's mindtalk.org. Mind Talk is provided daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace treatment with a licensed medical or mental health professional of your choosing. The managing producer is Jim Brown in 26x2 Communications. The assistant to the executive producer, Lede Battle. Today's conversation was made possible by the support of Ariel Medley. Thank you very much. For more information about Mind Talk, please go to mindtalk.org. That's mindtalk.org. If you would like to be in touch with me directly, that number is 301-654-5286. And remember, if it's unacceptable, that's what it is. Unacceptable. You take care.